Good afternoon. Steve Capone for Blank Rome, representing the appellant Sage Software, Inc. and Sage Software Canada, LTD, in connection with this appeal. As your honors are aware, the appeal centers on the interpretation of a merger agreement whereby Sage acquired the wholly owned subsidiary of CA, a subsidiary that was based primarily in Canada, thus resulting in the cross-border tax issues giving rise to the party's dispute. Before jumping into what is in dispute on the appeal, I'd like to quickly highlight three things which are not in dispute, which I think are important points. The first is, it's clear from this 75-page merger agreement that the parties adopted a comprehensive scheme to allocate pre- and post-closing tax liabilities. The scheme simply stated was CA would be responsible for all pre-closing tax liabilities, Sage all post-closing, and neither party was to bear any financial risk for the other's tax liabilities. The second is that the tax liability giving rise to this dispute was undoubtedly and admittedly a liability resting solely with CA. Whatever monies will be owed by CA solely. And third, my client Sage was compelled by force of having its assets seized and sold to pay that tax liability to the tune of approximately $15 million, essentially making an interest-free multi-million dollar loan of indefinite duration for the benefit of CA's tax liability. What is in dispute is the interpretation of Section 10.10 of the merger agreement. And this court is faced with two competing interpretations, and I would respectfully submit that the resolution of that dispute centers on the word conflict. Under Delaware law of contract interpretation, if one proffers a reading of a contract that conflicts with the party's clear intent as divined from the four corners of the document and or conflicts with other provisions of the contract, rendering them a nullity or eviscerating those provisions, Delaware law says that's not the correct reading. Here, Sage proffers a reading of the contract which I think clearly upholds the party's intent as to how to allocate tax liability, and neither the court below nor CA has been able to identify a single provision that is in conflict with Sage's reading of the contract. In contrast, I think it's quite in harmony with the rest of the agreement. In contrast, CA proffers a reading of the contract which flies in the face of the party's tax allocation scheme that is evident throughout the document, and that it requires, again, my client to make this interest-free loan of an indefinite period. It also conflicts with numerous other provisions of the contract.
Just so I'm clear, if you get all the money back from Canadian authorities, they don't give you any interest, is that right?
Under CA's reading of the contract, exactly, Your Honor, it's an interest-free loan. If this takes 10, 15, 20 years to resolve, my client is out $14 million in counting, no interest.
Well, it may be a loan, but is it undisputed that it's interest-free? I mean, that's not before us, is it? Or are you conceding that there would be no right to interest?
What I'm conceding is under CA's reading of the contract, under 10.10, their argument is it's interest-free, which is another reason we think it's an incorrect reading. We believe that Section 10.10 would require them, in light of the breach, to pay us the 6%.
Is it established that even if their reading is correct, that there would be no interest owing whenever the time comes that your client gets reimbursed? I mean, there is a hold harmless provision in the agreement, and one could at least argue that under the hold harmless, you know, while there may be no interest while this money, before there's a final resolution, of who owes how much, there would be interest owing on the money that was loaned out, at least temporarily on an interest-free basis.
Justice Jacobs, when you use the word established, the court below did not address that issue specifically. CA takes the position that under its reading, which was a reading adopted by the court below, that interest would not accrue now or later.
And do you agree with that?
We absolutely do not agree with their reading or with the fact that interest would not accrue. We believe that Section 10.10 is read.
Let me be very specific. Assuming that your view does not prevail, that is your view, the interpretation of the disputed provision does not prevail, is it established that your client has no right to interest, or is that an issue that's reserved for another day?
It was neither established, as far as I would read the opinion, nor is it reserved for another day. I assume it would be a point of contention in the future. We would evaluate this court's decision with the lower court's decision to see what options are available. I don't know if I can answer it any more surely than that.
And help me understand the record, and this really relates to the second count of the complaint, but I think it's relevant to what you're talking about now. And when the second count of the complaint was addressed in the Vice Chancellor's opinion, he seemed to suggest that if you'd have pursued this under 8.2, you might have prevailed and you would have even gotten these interim payments, but that you didn't decide to do that. And he seems to suggest that your client concluded it had an interest in challenging this, which I can't understand. So tell me, as I understand your position, you did everything you had to do because you had an obligation to cooperate and make sure that CA didn't spend a lot of money on taxes if it had a legitimate challenge to the tax assessment. But otherwise, you were simply a conduit for what was really something related on the merits to CA, which would seem to suggest CA was in charge. But the Vice Chancellor said, well, you did this together. CA wasn't in charge. You're not entitled to these interim payments. Right idea, wrong part of the contract, you lose. And I read your reply brief as saying, well, no, that's the whole argument we're making under count two, that we ought to be able to get these interim payments, and if we don't get the interim payments, we ought to be able to back out of this tax imbroglio that's going to go on for the next decade, and CA can either decide to pursue it or not. So with that background in mind, tell me why in the world your client is interested in a tax assessment that it's never going to have to pay.
You raised several points, Justice Holland. If I could address the first. The lower court, I believe, has just incorrectly understood the contract. His comments, which were sort of dicta that we should have filed under Section 8, mechanically are just wrong. Section 8 is a standalone reimbursement provision for taxes. Section 10.3A(i) specifically states that if a party breaches its obligations under Section 8, they become indemnification obligations under Section 10. I made the comment, which the Vice Chancellor noted, that the parties had sort of, the argument had matured past the Section 8, Section 10 argument. That is because CA refused to abide by Section 8, therefore breaching, therefore becoming a 10.3 obligation, subjecting, getting back to Justice Jacobs' point, CA to the 6% obligation, which would not otherwise be contained in Section 8. So I could not bring it. Getting to your point about being a conduit, my client had no choice. It had a choice. It had a Hobson's choice. It had the choice of contractually following the agreement, filing the document prepared by CA to initiate half of the cross-border proceeding, being subject and having to write a check to do so, or not writing the check, having its assets sold, or not filing that document. And if it doesn't file that document under Section 8, under Section in the 10s, what ends up happening is CA is therefore, has the argument, is relieved of its indemnity obligation because as a result of my client's conduct, it lost the opportunity to argue that it should not owe any taxes. So, you know, standard, who controls indemnity provision? If you don't go along with the party that controls and they are harmed, they get to walk away from their liability. So,
well, I didn't see where the Vice Chancellor addressed this in the first part of your answer to my question about the interim payments, we'll call them under 8, becoming part of your indemnification claim under 10, because the Vice Chancellor kept focusing on the concept that it had to be final, and if it wasn't final, you didn't have to pay it. But you're saying what would otherwise be an interim payment and that you were not reimbursed for in a timely way became a final obligation. And therefore, you know, I realize you have this other argument related to provided and the significance of semicolons.
Yes.
But before we get to that, let's just focus on finality.
Yeah, Your Honor, it's not an issue of finality the way the agreement's written. If you have the payments in Section 8, say, reimbursed for copying costs, legal fees, tax filing fees, et cetera, if the 8.3 and 8.7 deal specifically with tax payments, if you don't make those payments in the time prescribed under Section 8, they become an indemnity claim. They're no longer an 8 claim. They become an indemnity claim under 10.3. So it's whether you want to call it finality or which clause you sue under, it becomes an indemnity claim.
But doesn't the indemnity claim encompass the interest that would have been payable, if any, on the interim payment, that is the 50% of the assessed tax?
Your Honor, yes, from the standpoint of, I think the way we read Section 10.10, once it becomes an indemnity claim, you have 10 days to pay it, or the 6% clock starts to run. That is our reading. Again, that's not the other side's reading. I'm not sure how the lower court addressed it, but that's our reading. That, for example, in this scenario, we believe that CA had an absolute obligation to pay the money. It was its obligation, or reimburse my client. If it chose to roll the dice, it knew it was going to inherit a 6% charge for rolling the dice. Their reading is, I can gamble on your nickel. And if I win, I keep the money, and if I lose, it's your money. And we think that just flies in the face of this very comprehensive tax indemnity scheme that is, you know, replete throughout this document.
The reason I ask these questions about the interest is that in your brief, you appear to be arguing as one of the equities of the case that favors your side, that the other side's reading, which was accepted by the Vice Chancellor, in effect subjects your client to making an indefinite interest-free loan that may not be paid back for 20 years, and even so, the time value of it would be diminished because there wouldn't be compensation for the time value of that money. But it appears that that's not established. That is, that's not an established fact that we can assume for purposes of your argument. Correct.
To be candid, Your Honor, that's your call.
The position that you take is your call. I'm just asking you what it is.
The position that we're taking, Your Honor, is that it is unclear how the lower court, whether the lower court addressed that issue. All I can say is I know the lower court.
We're not being asked to address it. You're just arguing it as an equity. And I'm asking, is that an equity? Is that a real equity or a fictitious equity?
Being a de novo review, this court is free to render any reading of Section 10.10. To the extent when it renders that reading of 10.10, our primary argument is that the 6% would apply, and this court would be free to. You say it's not before the court, but the court, I think, is within its purview to render a reading that resolves that issue, hence why we raised it. And I do think it goes to the equities as well.
Well, it does go to the equities. I'm not certain that it's raised in the sense that this court is being asked to adjudicate it. We're being asked to adjudicate finality, and that is the issue of when the principal payment was due. Whether or not interest is due on that seems to be a separate issue that's not comprehended by this appeal, so I don't understand where you're coming from.
Sorry, clarify, Your Honor. I think the argument there, how finality ties into interest, is the interest starts to accrue 10 days after the payment is due. So therefore, if the court determines that, adopts CA's argument, that finality means when the competent authority proceeding is resolved, I think logically the payment will be due 10 days after that period, and if not paid within 10 days, then interest starts to accrue. That's the argument that CA's advanced. So I think it may not have been teed up that way, and we are at step one, but if you apply step one and let it flow through, it puts interest in question.
Can you clarify what happened with this discussion we see about a letter of credit?
Yes. The letter of credit was, factually stepping back, when the agreement was negotiated and executed, for 5 years, the two senior vice presidents of tax who were responsible for that section of the agreement operated to address tax payments. When this tax liability came due, the senior vice president of tax for CA said, we're going to take care of it. Can you find out, Sage, if the Canadian government will accept a letter of credit instead of cash? We pursued that avenue on their behalf. The Canadian government came back and said, we do not want a letter of credit. We want cash. In the interim, there was a new senior vice president of tax. He read the agreement differently and said, not only are we not going to do a letter of credit, we don't owe the money, period. So there was a lot of flux going on at that period of time. But that's the nub of the letter of credit issue. As I mentioned, I think the conflict is sort of the word of the day from my perspective, and I think if you can show, which we have, that CA's reading conflicts with other provisions, it should not be the adopted reading. And there's a specific example that we highlight in our reply brief. I'd like to just run this by the court real quick. And that is Section 8.3 and 8.7 of the agreement. Standing alone, Section 8 is not subject to Section 10. Section 10.10 deals with tax indemnity payments. 8 is a separate provision. 8.3 and 8.7 require CA to reimburse Sage in advance for payroll taxes and transfer taxes that were pre-acquisition, which is specific taxes they knew were coming due. Under CA's reading of the agreement, if they breach and they don't pay that money in advance as required under Section 8, it becomes a 10.3 indemnity obligation. At that point, the sort of the rubber meets the road with, I think, the illogic of CA's argument, because under CA's argument, it can simply not pay that amount, enter into litigation with my client, and then it is relieved under the finality language of its obligation to make that payment until after years of litigation with Sage. So what you have is a reading which results in a clear obligation being excused and a party being incentivized to breach the contract as a result of the reading of 10.10. Under Sage's reading, what you see is that obligation remains an obligation, and now, as a result of not paying it, you inherit a 6% charge, i.e. reinforcing the concept that one party should not bear the tax burden of another party's liability. And I think we raise this issue. CA has been unable to explain away that conflict, and it's an example of the other conflicts with all of Section 8. All of Section 8 goes on and says you must reimburse the other party for copying costs, legal fees, transfer, anything.
While you're in Section 8, and tell the court why you are you permitted unilaterally to get out of this competent authority proceeding, and do you need some court's permission to do that? What's your position with regard to your ability to just say, all right, we're done, we're going to not pursue this any further?
Our position is that I think under the contract, CA controls. Argument we would have is, we have two arguments. The first one is sort of declaratory judgment. We want the court's blessing to remove ourselves from the competent authority, therefore making it final, because if we take that action without some form of blessing or interpretation, we run the risk of being liable for that entire $20-some million liability that's clearly right now and admittedly CA's. So, Your Honor, getting to the point is, I think if our argument was, if you read the contract the way they read it, to uphold the party's intent, it should be reformed, and we should be able to remove ourselves from the competent authority proceeding, which is, the benefit of our bargain is Sage's money was not supposed to be tied up to pay for CA's tax liabilities.
Well, tell me, what's the Vice Chancellor talking about in his opinion when he suggests that CA could have been put in a position where it had to elect to control the competent authority process?
It was not put in, it could not be put into the position. It simply had the right. It's liability, so it has the right to either control or not control. My client has no say over that. We simply would go and say, excuse me, it's your claim. What do you want to do? They chose to control. They chose to fill out the paperwork. They importantly, CA initiated. It takes both sides. So CA initiated the process with the IRS. They directed us to initiate the process with the Canadian government, therefore compelling the two entities to speak. One side or the other doesn't get you there. They filled out the paperwork, instructed us to file it. My client has done nothing other than supply information when requested. Neither party sits at the table in this proceeding, which is why we don't feel it's a dispute. It's strictly between the governments. But CA has retained the financial advisors, the accountants, et cetera, to make their case and their arguments to their respective bodies. My client simply supplies information. So they did control, and I'm not sure what the Vice Chancellor was alluding to. Getting to the conflict issue, aside from, again, I think the reading not creating conflicts with the contract, there's another important aspect, which is this contract includes a dispute resolution mechanism in Section 10.6. The parties chose to address that issue. And that section says, for all claims other than tax claims, you have to first negotiate for 30 days. If you can't agree, you litigate. It exempts tax claims, and there is no corresponding dispute resolution procedure for tax claims. Why? Well, clearly it was a deliberate choice. I mean, you had Skadden and Covington negotiating this document at length, and they drafted it. They knew what they were doing. The reason they didn't do so is because tax claims are non-negotiable. When the government says pay it, or we're going to seize your assets, it has to get paid. The party that bears the risk has to pay it and cannot dispute with the other party. They're free to dispute with the government, and again, but pay the freight for that dispute. If you want to challenge the Canadian Revenue Authority, in this case CA, it was obligated to reimburse my client and then pursue that challenge to its heart's content. There is no dispute resolution mechanism, and I think that has to be viewed as deliberate, and deliberate because the parties didn't want to find themselves in a position where a tax bill had to be paid, given the leverage that a government entity has to take your property. They didn't want it to be put in that position. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
One question, Mr. Capone. This Chancery case took the form of a declaratory judgment request.
What was
the relief you were seeking?
The relief we were seeking, there was a dispute between the parties as to how to interpret Section 10.10. We wanted the court to adjudicate whose reading of 10.10 was correct.
What relief were you seeking? A declaratory judgment or damages?
Damages would naturally flow, obviously, because there was no dispute as to who owes the money. Once you interpret the provision...
What was the basis, if it was for money, what was the basis of Chancery jurisdiction?
I'm not saying it was not. We were not suing for damages. We were suing simply for the interpretation, because both parties agreed on the rest of it. Once the language is decided...
This case could have been brought as a damages action in Superior Court.
This case could have been brought as a damages case in Superior Court. Thank you.
Well, let me ask you on that. Wasn't this a dispute over a merger agreement?
It was a dispute over the merger. Yes, it was a dispute over the interpretation and application of the merger agreement, seeking a declaration as to how that language should be adjudicated, contract, rest, jurisdiction solely in Delaware. So that's why we ended up in Delaware.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. David Teklitz on behalf of the defendant below, Appley CA Incorporated. This appeal presents a straightforward issue of contract interpretation regarding a merger agreement between two sophisticated parties where both parties agree that the contract or the provisions in question are clear and unambiguous. The court below applied Section 10.10, which both parties agreed was the provision at issue, to the facts pled in the complaint, and that's important. The court below looked at the claims in the complaint, looked at Section 10.10, which both parties pointed to, and applied the language that both parties agreed was clear and unambiguous. That ruling is fully supported by the language and should be affirmed by this court. In that regard, if you look at the complaint, Sage brought this case under Section 10.3, seeking indemnification. It's clear. In paragraph 24 of the complaint, they said, under Section 10.3, CA is required to indemnify Sage for the pre-closing period tax obligations. Therefore, the question presented to the Court of Chancery was a straightforward question. When did that obligation arise? And to answer that question, both parties pointed the court to Section 10.10. In their complaint again, Sage in paragraphs 3 and 10 and again in 25 in the prayer said the answer to the question can be found in Section 10.10. Sage told the Court of Chancery, because it was due and owing under Section 10.10, they were entitled to immediate indemnification. Importantly, however, in the same complaint, Sage conceded, as it had to, that the amount it was seeking was still subject to a review proceeding between the two revenue authorities. Therefore, reading the language of 10.10, and 10.10, as the Court of Chancery found, is fairly clear on this, it says, any amount owed by an indemnifying party to an indemnified party under this Article 10, that's what was at issue here, an indemnification under Article 10.3, Section 10.3, shall be paid following final resolution, which the contract defined as final in the sense that no longer subject to appeal or review of any dispute. It's that simple. It's that straightforward.
Before we get to the simple part, you heard your... opponents say today they got into Section 10 by way of Section 8, and because there wasn't this interim payment, and what's your response to that?
two responses. One, we're left with the complaint. They drafted it as a Section 10.3 claim. That's what you're dealing with when you're before the court chancery. But more importantly, I mean, it's a hypothetical, a speculative hypothetical. I don't understand that argument because they cite to 8.3, which deals with payroll tax, or 8.7 transfer taxes. There's no allegation CA didn't pay these. Now, but if they didn't.
That's by analogy. And what the vice chancellor said in his opinion is if they would have started with Section 8, they might have had a pretty good claim for payment. And the response is we did start with Section 8. And that's how we got to Section 10. And you're saying that's not supported by the record.
Well, I don't think it's supported by the record. I don't think it's supported by the contract. Because if we breach 8, if I'm the plaintiff, I'm suing for a breach of Section 8. There's nothing in this contract that requires you to go to Section 10. You sue. If we didn't pay the payroll taxes under 8.3, you sue for breach of not paying the payroll taxes. You seek prejudgment interest, and you pursue that. If you don't pay the transfer taxes, you sue under 8.7, you seek prejudgment interest, and you go forward. If they thought they had an argument or a breach under 8.2, you would have drafted 8.2 argument. You could have gone to Superior Court or the Chancery Court and said, CA breached Section 8.2. There was no requirement to go to Section 10. And I think it's important. I don't think they had a claim under 8.2, and I think they conceded they didn't have a breach under 8.2. If you read their complaint,
And that's because the Section 8 obligations deal with enumerated categories of obligations, and this particular tax assessment didn't fit under any of those?
It certainly didn't fit under 8.3 or 8.7. 8.2, that's a whole different issue. That's usually dealing with administrative tax. Certainly wasn't specifically provided under 8.2. Could have they made an argument as the vice chancellor hypothesized at the time? I mean, we would argue it was a joint decision to file this. We certainly never took control. The vice chancellor found there's no evidence that we ever took control that would have brought 8.2. But arguably somebody could have made that argument. The vice chancellor would have dealt with it. But the simple fact is they didn't make it. It's not in the complaint. The argument is not made.
Well, I understand we're going to get into the language of this agreement. But at the end of the day, your position seems to be they signed the contract that obligated them to file whatever papers were necessary to challenge taxes that would ultimately be paid by your client. And part of the agreement also was that they were going to be out of pocket $14 million for perhaps 10 years until there was a final judgment. And to the extent they made a bad agreement, they're stuck with it.
Not completely. Our argument would be twofold. One is they could have up front said that they didn't want to, or they would only file it if we controlled the litigate, took control and paid the administrative costs. They didn't do that because, as the vice chancellor found, or at least hypothesized, they had very good reasons of their own maybe to file this as a joint application.
And what were they?
Well, I think they would be twofold. One, and this is again from the opinion, one was that they had a business, an ongoing business relationship with CA. These are both large computer companies. They might have wanted to keep good business relations. And number two is they continue to own these businesses. There may be some help to them to know how the two revenue authorities interpret these provisions as to sharing of costs between a Canadian and an American. It's all hypothesizing. The point is the vice chancellor found that it was a joint application and both parties decided to file it. And we never took control of the application.
And what, if anything, do we read into the fact that your client was willing to provide a letter of credit?
Yeah. Well, again, twofold on that, Your Honor. They said in the spirit of the agreement, pay half and we'll pay half. I think, again, my client had some good business relationship, was trying to work something out here that made sense for both. But I think the important legal point is the contract's clear and unambiguous. You don't get to extrinsic evidence such as that. There's no extrinsic evidence as to the negotiation of the contract. Nobody has put in any evidence what the parties thought this meant at the time that it was negotiated. This after the contract extrinsic evidence, much of it is in the context where a tax basket was paying these, or there was no issue that it was final. Therefore, this issue as currently presented was never dealt with before this case by the parties. And just addressing one more point, because it seems like the court's concerned with the equities here, that my client's getting something that it shouldn't be. But But there was a very good reason why this was drafted the way it has, and it's played out. If we front it, if we're forced to front this $14 million to the Canadian Tax Authority, CA, we have no independent right to get it back. We don't own it. It all goes through the current company. If it turns out that it's less than $14 million owed, we're then stuck out of the money, either having to get Sage to go to the Canadian Taxing Authority and get it back for us, which I assume they would have no authority or no incentive to want to do, and we might be on the flip side suing them to try to get them to get the money back for us from the Canadian Tax Authority. Therefore, it put the risk where, you know, when this was negotiated, it put the risk with the party that was had the direct involvement with the taxing authorities.
But I thought the overall design of this agreement was that the risk as to taxes was clearly defined as being taxes before a certain date and taxes after a certain date, and that this particular tax assessment fell on your client's side of the fence.
Yeah, maybe I wasn't being precise. I meant the risk of finality. There's no dispute that once it's final, my client has to pay.
Well, but you know, you're stepping from one point to the next, and if the risk with respect to tax payments was supposed to be based upon the point in time at which these tax assessments related to, and if it's undisputed, as I believe it is, that this is a tax assessment relating to a point in time that your client is responsible for, then how do we jump from that to the risk shifting to opposing client with respect to a tax that's your tax?
There's two answers to that. One, again, is this was never specifically provided, this type of tax under the agreement like some other taxes. But more importantly, the thing that was provided for, as in many cases, is when would it be due? And it's clear here the payment from us to them was not due until it was finally resolved.
Okay. And, all right. So let's get to that then for a minute. I understand that as between the United States and Canada, they're talking or disputing or whatever. But as I understand the facts, it's also undisputed that Canada had the right and exercised its right to demand a portion of those taxes to be paid by a specific date, or they could take the Sage's property, correct?
That's correct.
So you're saying because another aspect of this problem is still in dispute, you don't have any obligation to pay under Section 10.10, even though a portion of that obligation has become final because Canadian government said you got to pay, and we don't care what's going on elsewhere.
Well, a very important answer to that is the amount they had to pay to Canada. Everybody agrees the amount that ultimately is going to be paid is a lot less than that, and has turned out to be. I mean, this isn't in the record because this has happened after the appeal, and I'm not sure. I didn't hear him withdraw the second count of this argument, but as is my understanding, that this has been finally resolved between the two taxing authorities at this point. So I would assume the second part of this argument is moot. But for purposes of interpreting the finality requirement, if the reason why it's written the way it is and my client doesn't have to front the money, as I just went over, is because that was a deposit. But because the ultimate tax liability, the record shows, was likely to be less than that deposit, as I said, my client, the agreement did not require him to take on the risk of having to go try to recover or recoup the overpayment of paying before it was a final review.
All right. Let me see if I understand this. The Canadian Taxing Authority says you have to pay X number of million dollars now, even though we understand that there's a dispute between the two countries as to how much tax you actually owe to Canada. Sure enough, it turns out that Canada asked for more money and got more money than it was ultimately determined to be entitled to, right?
Yes.
Are you suggesting that the Canadian Taxing Authority then would not reimburse the payor of those taxes?
Yeah.
That there'd be a fight about that with the Canadian authorities?
Well, I'd be hypothesizing. I don't know what would happen, but in any event, that reimbursement would flow back through Sage, Canadian.
Right.
And this is part of the problem here is any additional tax that Canada gets credited against the American. There's no additional tax being paid here. One country gets paid, the other gives the credit, so it's a wash. The problem is that Sage now controls both of these two companies, both of the subsidiaries, the American and the Canadian. So it gets very complicated as to how you, for taxes that were paid 4 years ago, where does the credit go? Which tax returns need to be amended? How does it work? If the Americans are giving a tax credit, they're going to presumably be giving it to a Sage subsidiary today. The money would not flow back necessarily right to CA. It's a whole other negotiation that needs to occur once the finality as to the amount that's due and how it's going to be applied and credited as to where the money actually comes and where it goes.
So you're saying that even now that there's a decision from the competent authority proceeding, it's still not finally resolved because we have to decide who gets credits and who for what tax year get amended and all of that?
My understanding is that the parties are still working with the IRS to try to figure out how it gets credited back against the tax returns of the American subsidiary.
But is the competent authority proceeding over?
My understanding from the letter I saw that they've finished their review, and that's been closed.
So why isn't this appeal moot?
Well, the second part of the appeal is moot, I assume. I assume if you ask the petitioner why they're continuing with the first part of the appeal is because they want to try to collect interest someday.
Well, everybody has wishes. My question is, do we have jurisdiction? Because the predicate for the vice chancellor's decision was based on finality. And if the competent authority proceeding is final, why aren't we under what everybody agrees is the reading of Section 10, end of case, time for people to start exchanging checks?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a question for the petitioner, but I assume what you'll hear is that they want to preserve some right to go back and get interest because we should have paid the money earlier under their
interpretation. That reminds me of the McMillan case we had in 1989 where the proceeding changed from being defensive to being a sale of the company, and everyone wanted us to decide the defensive case that was under advisement because it was a defense that hadn't been adjudicated yet. And we said, well, we could understand why you'd like to find out the answer to the legitimacy of that defense, but we only have jurisdiction over cases and controversies.
I think
the matter of interest has not been addressed. Is that correct by the Chancellor?
The matter of interest, it only has been addressed under Section 10.10 for purpose of 10.10. I don't believe the argument or the claim or potential claim that Vice Chancellor Justice Jacobs espoused was ever presented to the Chancery Court.
So it's still an open question?
It's not part of this complaint. I assume the new complaint could be filed trying to recover that interest, or a new claim could be made. I don't think that claim was ever made or presented to the Court of Chancery.
So then on the issues raised before the Chancellor, those have all been resolved?
You're saying mooted or resolved? I don't think, you know, again, I feel like I'm making the arguments for the other side. I would certainly, favor a mootness, ruling. I just think that the argument that I will hear is that, oh, no, if my reading of 10.10 was right and the vice chancellor got it wrong, I have a better claim for interest, or I have a stronger claim for interest under 10.10, and I wouldn't have to be going under 10.3.
Well, and we appreciate your candor, but if, in fact, the competent authority proceeding is over and we now have finality, it looks like it's time for your client to pay the money.
As I said, it's a question of how you pay the money, because they're going to be...
That's a different question. But wouldn't it appear to be that's where we are?
Yeah. I agree. We now know what is owed. They've said this much more taxable income in Canada. We're going to somehow credit that taxable income against one of the American entities. I think they're trying, as on my understanding, they're trying to work out exactly how you do that when these tax returns are from the early 2000s.
Well, let me ask the question a different way. What is this court going to decide if we decide this case on the merits that's relevant at all to anything the parties are doing if the competent authority proceeding is now final?
Well, I agree that the second part of the appeal is moot. On the first part, I would respectfully request you affirm the Court of Chancery's finding that as to the claim that was brought under 10.3, that if you apply the language of 10.10, that CA did not have an obligation to immediately indemnify, which is what the Sage was seeking, but that its obligation to indemnify did not arise until the review proceeding ended. So I respectfully request an affirmation of the first Court of Chancery's ruling on the first count of the complaint below, applying Section 10.10 to the claim that was actually pled in the complaint under Section 10.3.
And that would be helpful to you, because to the extent you have to pay interest, it would have the interest run at a much later date.
Exactly. I think for the most of the arguments have been fairly fluid as we've proceeded through here, through this case since the beginning. We started with both parties focused on Section 10.10, saying the court need look no further than 10.10. I think that most of the arguments I would rely upon are papers that they made under 10.10, unless the court has questions, because I think that Sage has not provided an alternative reading of 10.10 that would make any sense consistent with the language. For example, they say the first clause of 10.10 is limited to non-tax-related. The second clause relates to tax-related indemnification. There's no support for that in the language of the actual agreement. And as the Vice Chancellor pointed out, Section 10.10 starts out broadly in broad defining terms of any amount sought under Section 10.10. With respect to the proviso arguments, again, I think the Vice Chancellor correctly cited the authorities that provide that if you have proviso language like provided that it is read as a limitation on the first right. So here the right to indemnification was further limited by the second proviso. The second proviso didn't create some independent obligation to pay taxes to pay indemnification. And this is supported by the fact that the second clause is written in the negative. It says that CA shall not be required to pay, which clearly signifies that it was intended to be a limitation on the rights granted under the first clause. Sage also made the argument at one point that the finality language was limited to only disputes between CA and Sage. Again, the Vice Chancellor has correctly pointed out, if you actually read the language, it's broadly written as to require final resolution of any dispute regarding the amount. And at one point, Sage made the argument that they had finality here. But again, as the Vice Chancellor held, they conceded in the complaint that the amount in dispute was still subject to a review proceeding. And if you read the actual broad language of 10.10, it says any review, which must mean something different than appeal. And clearly, the competent authority process fits within the definition of a review.
Let me try to clarify something in my own mind. The competent authority proceeding was to determine out of whatever the total number is of taxes due, how much of it goes to Canada and how much of it goes to the United States, correct?
Correct.
But that total number was not being changed, was it?
The assumption is it will not be changed, is to prevent double taxation. So CA already paid to the American taxing authorities.
Okay, well, since CA is going to have to pay both sides of this, right?
It already paid.
Okay, but what I'm getting at in terms of finality, when it got to the competent authority, what was going on was a division between the two countries of who gets what, but the dollar amount had been set, correct?
And already paid years ago. CA paid the amount to the IRS, the amount in dispute. So the Canadians were saying that CA paid too much to the IRS and wanted some of that money back. So at the end of the day, no additional money is going to be paid. It's just a question of allocation.
All right.
I think that's important here, too. These were intercompany charges because you had a Canadian and an American subsidiary. The taxable income was set. They paid the taxes to the IRS. The Canadian said, oh, no, the intercompany charge was wrong. That money should have been paid to us. And to prevent double taxation, that's why this process is created. Just in conclusion here.
So, well, before you do that, what's going to happen to the money that Sage has paid?
I assume that it will get it back. The overpayment it will get back from the Canadian taxing authorities, the actual, you know, taxable, additional taxable income, it will get back as a credit from through the IRS to one of its subsidiaries. Now, I guess if there is any difference, and it's beyond my level of sophistication as to, you know, when you have different tax rates or different ways, you know, these negotiation goes, I assume if it does end up there's some slight difference that CA is obligated under 10.3 to make up the difference. But how it's supposed to work in theory is that there would be no additional tax. This is meant to prevent double taxation. So whatever gets paid to Canadian, you get a credit from the United States for.
So CA is not going to have to pay any money unless this court or some court sometime in the future concludes that they should have made the payment that Sage made, and since they didn't, Sage is entitled to interest from CA.
That is the assumption, I believe. And I think what's important to take away from this is the Court of Chancery, was a predicate for its decision, was that this is a very complex merger agreement that was negotiated between two sophisticated parties and includes a number of trade-offs of economic terms. One of these trade-offs was the express term of 10.10 with regard to who would have the obligation with respect to finality if there was a dispute. And on this narrow issue that was presented by the complaint and the interpretation of Section 10.10, both parties agree, and the Court of Chancery agreed, that the language of 10.10 is clear and unambiguous. There's only one reading that makes sense. And that reading supports the grant of summary judgment in favor of CA. And we respectfully request the court to affirm that ruling.
One last question. Is there a live, viable claim for interest that's before the Court of Chancery?
I believe the Court of Chancery dealt with every claim that was before it. You know, again, you, as you pointed out, was drafted as a declaratory judgment. Whether that complaint could ever be amended or whether a new complaint could be, you know, made, I think it would be, that's one of those two would be necessary to raise the issue.
So on the record that currently exists, there is no claim reserved to determine interest?
No, I believe the Court of Chancery ruled on all claims before. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Teklitz started by making the correct observation. This is a fairly straightforward issue of contract interpretation.
Well, before we get there, is the competent authority proceeding over?
Not to my knowledge. I heard lots of new testimony today, but my client has not received a check, an offer for a check. I've not been told that it's been resolved. I know it's a bureaucracy. They could sit down and say, we think we worked it out, but there's been no issue, order, opinion, decision, final resolution, as they define it, to my knowledge. Again, it's not the record, but it's not over. And I think the touchstone of that, aptly pointed out, Justice Holland, if they thought it was over, how come they didn't write a check to resolve this issue? They clearly don't think it's over.
Well, what we were just told is they're never going to have to write a check. At the most, they simply have to pay you for interest if you ever brought a claim for interest and could show you were entitled to it. But as far as the money your client paid, it's simply going to be an allocation between the governments. Your client will get some credit on some tax returns, but it's never going to get any money.
That is just that misunderstands the concept of a competent authority proceeding. If I could briefly clarify that, it was cross-border accounting. CA owned an asset in Canada, which my client acquired. CA owned many other businesses in the U.S. When it sold product between CA's businesses that it owned then and it owns now, and its subsidiary in Canada, it chose to pay taxes in the U.S. on those transactions and to short the Canadian government. Canadian government came in and said, no, you should have paid those taxes up here. So the issue is, the CA, that's why CA initiated in the United States, CA current businesses are saying, we already pay taxes on that, and if you make us pay it again in Canada, we'll get double taxed. My client never paid the taxes, never will pay their taxes, won't get a credit because it's not our money. What happened is the Canadian government will say, you owe us even more money, which means the IRS gives CA a refund, or the Canadian government says, oops, we were wrong, don't worry about it, here's your $14 million back. In which case my client, I guess, presumably will get that check back. This is not about the allocation between my client's U.S. and Canadian subsidiaries. This is an allocation of taxes between CA and its subsidiaries. So that just fundamentally misunderstands how the process works. Justice Ridgely, you raised an issue which I think gets to a question Justice Jacobs, you asked of me, which is this final or declaratory judgment? At the time the suit was brought, and currently it was brought as a declaratory judgment in part because the Canadian government, like the U.S. government, has many taxing levels. We were required to make a payment to the central government, but the various other taxing authorities were sending bills saying, in light of what the central government did and the reclassification, you now owe us money. So there were multiple checks being written before and after the complaint was filed, and theoretically will continue to be written as the Canadian governments decide how they want to handle this. So it was an ongoing problem, not a we have a damage, some certain. And that's why we're looking for an interpretation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.